from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Kathleen Willey, Juanita Broderick, then Donald Trump in the middle. Kathy Shelton, Paula Jones. These are women who have made very strong accusations against Bill Clinton.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Secretary Clinton, I want to follow up on that. I'm going to let you talk about it now.
Because everything he just said is absolutely false, but I'm not surprised.
Really. Paul Ryan is going to focus on for the next month is exclusively on keeping Congress in control of the Republicans, saying they need to be a check on a possible Hillary Clinton presidency.
Well, that's some of the news we're going to be talking about today in The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Hope your Wednesday is off to a really good start here. And we've got a lot to talk about. Most of it's going to be about national politics, but we'll also get into some things happening at the state level as well with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Bill Curry is here. He's our Democratic political analyst. Hello there, Bill.
Good morning, sir. Nice to be here.
And Suzanne Bates is policy director for the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Hello once again, Suzanne.
Good morning.
So, okay, we're going to start, obviously, with the debate. There's a lot to talk about there. It's been talked about a bit over the course of the last couple of days, but I think that there's still a little bit more, maybe with some time, that we can digest from that. There's been some other news rolling along since then, and I do want to get a chance to talk with Colin McEnroe about his compelling program yesterday with four Donald Trump supporters. But first of all, Colin, now that we have a little bit of time to digest the debate and some of the news of the last week, what are we thinking right now?
Well, I mean, in terms of the debate itself, I think, well, I'll say two things, and they're both the same thing, which is that all of Donald Trump's strengths can just as easily be weaknesses, and I think they are right now. And I'll give you two examples. One of them is one of his strengths has been the ability to kind of flood the zone with information and with news so that you know, nothing becomes too big a problem for him because nothing can be paid very much attention to. They're just too much content. It's drinking from a fire hose. Pick your metaphor. But so that's really worked very well for him in a lot of ways, and it has minimized damage that he might have done to himself while maximizing his kind of Scarlet Pimpernel, you know, ability to dash around saying all kinds of provocative things and then moving on to the next thing while the media goes, wait a minute, is that true? Should we fact check that? Is that, you know, and so the problem with that is now there are certain things that he would like the media to pay attention to stop and pay attention to, and he can't get them to. So one of them would be, I mean, I think one of the reasons that the parade of wronged women that he set up for this kind of bizarre media event right before the debate, where he, in fact, invited the media there under a completely different pretext. But, I mean, I think one of the reasons it didn't have the impact, I mean, it was a bad idea anyway for a bunch of reasons that I'm sure we'll discuss. But I also think there just isn't bandwidth to handle it. And similarly, he would really like the media right now to be paying attention to some of the things that are in the WikiLeaks dump. And the media is paying zero attention to it right now. Not because the media is in the tank for Hillary Clinton so much as there's just, once again, is not the bandwidth for it. The other example I'll give of this is one of the ways that Trump has been strong is in this sense that he's very authentic and unscripted and unmanageable and uncontrollable. He does exactly what he wants. And people kind of like that about him. The problem is there are moments, and a debate is one of them, where you have to be coachable, right? You have to sort of work on certain kinds of talking points, and you have to work on just the choreography of a debate. You know, Bill Clinton famously with a town hall debate knew supposedly on his first one all the camera angles going and knew where to stand to be in a two-shot with the person he was talking to, the right kind of two-shot. And, of course, we all know what happened with Trump's debate. I mean, the one thing you know if you're being coached by the most rookie political operative about a town hall debate is that George Bush essentially lost one by, or, you know, so goes the wisdom anyway, by glancing at his watch, and, you know, that Al Gore, you know, sighed. Now, I think that was not a town hall debate, but like little things, little physical things can hurt you. So what does he do? I mean, he walks around the stage like this creepy guy on a subway platform, you know, is following you around and stands behind her and then goes back and grabs his chair and kind of humps it a little bit. And it's just like you just realize that this is a guy who all of that authenticity, all of that don't tell me what to do stuff that really worked kind of well under other circumstances is now militating heavily against him.
And you could tell that it was a big problem when Trump's campaign manager directly after the debate began saying that all the media's going to be paying attention to how he was standing behind her, and that's not really the most important thing to look at. Obviously, that's what everyone was looking at. Colin mentioned something, though, Bill, that I want to get to maybe in a little bit more detail in a bit. Trump had a chance during this debate, and the moderators had a chance during this debate to actually seize on the other piece of important information that had come out over the course of the previous few days. One was the Access Hollywood tape. And again, I sort of can't imagine that we're talking about this, but here we are. And that's what the first part of the debate was about and what the national conversation was about. There was also this new WikiLeaks dump of a whole bunch of information that included things that Hillary Clinton had said in private and during private speeches, which had a whole bunch of the sorts of information that Donald Trump, his supporters, and the Republican Party at large would like to have us focusing on. And he didn't really even bring it up, which seemed like an odd thing to do when you're trying to take the heat off yourself.
Well, again, I agree with Colin. I mean, we all know who Trump is and his complete lack of impulse control. And he was too busy stalking the stage like an ex-husband under a temporary restraining order to focus almost on any kind of issue. The thing about both these sets of leaks is that we didn't learn anything new about either person. And, you know, for all the Republicans who are now getting off the Trump bandwagon because of this tape, many people have asked quite rightly, what didn't you know about the, you know, how did you miss this? This has been 1 year, a ceaseless tableau of barbaric and repulsive behavior, and you just figured it out. And with Hillary, my basic take, and there's so many documents that have been dumped by WikiLeaks here that I don't think anybody, even people who do nothing but follow it full time, have really figured it all out yet or gone through it all. But what they've printed so far, there's really not anything there. You know, if you thought that Hillary wasn't pandering to the Wall Street audiences when she gave the speeches, then maybe you were finally shocked to find that she was. One of the reasons I think that Trump didn't go after it is that it would have been pretty hard for the Trump people to find exactly how to take what we have so far on the record and make much of it. For Clinton, if this is all there is in the WikiLeaks dumps, if this is it, then you know, what I said a couple shows back, that her real opponent was not Donald Trump but Julian Assange, then she's won that race too.
Among the things that are said in this stack of emails, and it is very hard to go through, is, you know, she talks about a dream of a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders. Just that word open borders, seeing as how it hits on a key theme of Donald Trump, might be something that he would want to bring up over and over again. Not that he hasn't, Suzanne, already tried to distinguish himself from Hillary Clinton around this issue, but that it does allow him to get back to some sort of a talking point that resonates both with his base, but also largely with the Republican Party and people who are against Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I think watching the debate, I mean, I do have some sympathy for his argument that it was, you know, 3-1. I mean, the moderators definitely wanted to follow up on the attacks that she was making. And they didn't want to follow up when he made an attack on Hillary. So he did try to bring up some of those things. They didn't follow up on that. They pressed him pretty hard on things like the tapes, you know. And so, you know, like Bill said, I mean, I guess the leaks that have come out, we knew that he was crass and she was dishonest. And these everything that's leaked.
Actually not what I
well,
said.
Well, no, but that you said that it reinforced
yeah,
those stereotypes.
Difference here, but go ahead.
Well, OK, well, so that's my take that, you know, he's crass and she's dishonest. And I think that everything that's come out over the last little bit has reinforced that feeling. You know, there's the ABC did a story on Haiti and how the Clinton Foundation, Friends of Bill organizations that were putting aid into Haiti after the earthquake got special preference over other aid groups. I mean, these kinds of things are bothersome and disturbing. And I think in any other campaign, any other year, they would be big news. But I think, you know, the focus is really on Trump right now and his flaws.
It's on Trump and his flaws. I mean, how do you think these last couple days has changed any of that? Given the flaws that we knew going in, again, no big surprises in the Access Hollywood tape. Finally, what this does is it forces some mainstream Republicans, whether it's Paul Ryan or John McCain, to come out and say, okay, look, I just can't do this anymore. I mean, I don't know how you feel any of this has moved the needle. Now Donald Trump says he's unshackled, and Lord knows whatever the hell that means. But
well, I think, you know, where it moved the needle, at least, so I follow, you know, a lot of the sort of conservative, the people on the right, and there's been that Never Trump group and then the Trump supporters and that kind of infighting that's going on over there. And I think where there were a lot of women that were not happy with Trump but kind of tepidly supportive of him when that tape came out, I think it just set a lot of conservative women off, and they it was just really disturbing to them. And so I think that's maybe what forced the hand of some of the others. And then, of course, he dropped so rapidly in the polls that I think maybe some people who felt like they had to support Trump all of a sudden felt freed from that. You know, I think they're in really I have some sympathy for Paul Ryan and some of these others. They're in a really difficult position. Their party chose this person. You know, their base chose this person. And so they've been trying to be loyal to not just Trump, but to those voters. You know, and so I think they're finding it really difficult to – it's a line that's very difficult to follow.
Well, and Colin, we heard some of this on your program yesterday, and I really do want to commend you for the show that you had. You had four Donald Trump supporters on. You just basically let them talk, make their case, and it really – it wasn't about Hillary Clinton. It wasn't about bashing her. It wasn't about the tapes in Access Hollywood. It was about why they feel Donald Trump is a better presidential candidate. One of the things I came away with was that feeling that Suzanne just said, which is for mainstream Republicans, those who really want to support whatever Republican candidate the party puts forward, this is indeed a difficult time, but it doesn't change their basic feeling of what they think a Republican candidate, no matter what his name is, would do versus any Democratic candidate, especially one with Clinton at the end of the name.
Yeah, and I'll just build on what Suzanne said because I think it's really interesting. And I think this is something that's hard to have kind of a hot take about because I think it's much more complicated than that. Well, what we have, obviously, is – I mean, for example, Trump is very fond of pointing out – he pointed it out yesterday, I think, that he got more votes in the Republican primary than anybody's ever gotten before. What he never points out is there were more votes cast against him or for other people than have ever been cast in a Republican primary before, which is what makes the job of Paul Ryan and anybody else very complicated because, yes, as Suzanne said, the voters, in a way, have spoken, but in a very divided field like that one, the voters also spoke very powerfully about not wanting Donald Trump, about wanting other people. They just couldn't coalesce around one single person that they wanted. And so similarly, you know, you have these – it turned out – we didn't plan it this way. We were just, you know, trolling around trying to find some Trump supporters who would go on the show, and one of them canceled at the last minute. We wound up with three former Marco Rubio supporters who had, you know, just made the transition. And as you say, some of this is, you know, habit of life, habit of mind. You're a Republican. You support the nominee. But then the question becomes, how far can the nominee depart from Republican orthodoxy before you don't feel like you're supporting a Republican nominee anymore? And I think that's been a challenge all along, really, for a lot of Republicans that, you know, that ultimately you'd like, you know, when you elect somebody anyway, usually you're not just electing the person, you're electing a whole bunch of people that they're going to bring in. You're electing, you know, essentially a party with a platform. You're, you know, there's a lot of things besides the person that come in. And I think in this case, that's a little bit more of an open question.
Well, and I guess I just want to wonder, because you use the word orthodoxy, and I think another maybe more generous way to say that is principles, right? The idea is that you have core conservative or Republican principles that don't mean you're just going to vote for whoever's on the ticket. But your guest yesterday, Colin, seemed to suggest, at least in their mind, that this candidate upheld some of the Republican principles that they stand for, maybe regardless of some of the other stuff, not just in orthodoxy that we're going to, you know, vote R as opposed to D.
Right. And, you know, I mean, once again, I see that as this is a really complicated question. I mean, the unkind and reductive thing to do would be to sort of say, well, in some ways you guys are being kind of good Germans about this in the sense that you're willing to look past an awful lot of stuff that really, you know, falls to me in the category of borderline hate speech or just, you know, xenophobia, bigotry, all this kind of stuff. These people who were on my show yesterday were not from the basket of deplorables in any sense of the word. They were, I think, if they're going to be 48 million or 50 million votes for Donald Trump, you know, most of them are going to be much more like these people. They're Republicans. On balance, they think Republican ideas are better than Democratic ideas. And they think Republican tax policy is going to be better than Democratic tax policy. I mean, and that's just sort of how they roll. And they have been willing to swallow hard and blink at some of the stuff that, you know, is really, really troubling to a whole bunch of other people. But, yeah, I mean, to me, that question, though, is – you know, Donald Trump doesn't really have some of the – like Donald Trump and Paul Ryan do not agree on a lot of really basic things. So if you think that Paul Ryan is the embodiment of the modern, you know, somewhat conservative Republican, he and Donald Trump on a lot of policy matters, they're not in the same boat.
Bill?
One, no one knows what Trump's for. I mean, no one has a clue. All you know about Trump is really is his character and the kind of, I know we've disagreed about this term, but at least proto-fascist threatening to jail your opponent and sue newspaper publishers and inciting crowds to violence, racism, conspiracy mongering, hyper-nationalism, et cetera. This is certainly – this is what the Republicans have nominated. And I think that the really – the good news here – did you think there was any? The good news here I think is that what may be about to happen is that Trump may be in Alf Landon territory, who got the least of a percentage of the vote of a major party candidate in the history of American presidential politics at 37%. He may actually hit that or go lower, the 1936 election against FDR. And you can't have a party – I don't think a new party can arise in America without a new major party can't really arise unless an old one dies. Our system is such that there's not really room for three. And the last time we had a new party was the Republican Party in 1856. It's been that long. But there's something as profound a change as you can possibly have is in the wings here. And it may be a good change from my vantage point, certainly, and I think from the country's, in that right now what holds the Democratic Party together, which was held together by Clinton in the 90s and Barack for the last 8 years, Trump holds the Democratic Party together now. Their revulsion for him. And Hillary was holding the Republican Party together, but now she can't. All their donors, all their elites, most of their elected officials, they're off. They're gone. And they're about to have that struggle over power. And the Democrats have a chance to win the Congress and the Senate and actually have a debate over all the issues we haven't been talking about in the election. There could be a new debate almost entirely within the Democratic Party, especially if they win both houses of Congress.
Well, what to do next
about all, you know, with all everything big in America is broken, and instead of debating it, we've spent the last year debating the brokenness of one little man, and now that's about to change. November 9th, that changes. Thank God.
Well, I want to actually spend some time in the next segment talking about some of those things, maybe from this bipartisan view, thinking about how we can solve some of those problems. But quickly, Suzanne. To that future of the Republican Party question, this is – I mean, you and I have talked about this on past shows. This was supposed to be what happened after the last time when Mitt Romney got skunked and there was supposed to be a bigger tent and the Republican Party was supposed to think in new ways about how to bend toward this new demographic shift in which America is going to look a lot browner than it does right now. It's going to look a lot different. Republican Party maybe needs to change right now. What do you think the Republican Party needs to focus on as we move into November 9th, not just November 8th, so that the next time around there's a conversation about different things than we're having right now?
So it's interesting. I know there was some talk after 2012 that the party needed to regroup. But, you know, there wasn't like the shockwave in 2012 that really was going to shake things up. But this year, I mean, talk about – there's a little bit of a civil war going on the right now. I'm an optimist about it. I think that conservatives will come out stronger than they did. I think they will regroup. I think there's going to be some realigning, even, you know, some of those blue Democrats who, you know, the sort of blue collar Democrats who've shifted over because they like Trump. I think there's going to be a realignment generally. I think we'll probably still end up with Democrats and Republicans. I think they might look different after this election. You know, I like to say that I think Republicans should focus more on ideas. I think that's what Paul Ryan's been trying to do. He's really come out with some really interesting conservative ideas, that a lot of which I admire. But I don't know that that's what people are hungry for. They're really hungry for that sort of outsider. I don't know. There's a hunger that I can't quite put my finger on. But I don't think the Democrats controlling all of Congress and the presidency are going to help.
But did Ryan, given what you just said, did he damage himself as a leader of a new Republican Party, having been part of the ticket in 2012 that lost and then nothing really changed within the party, then being the Speaker of the House who decided he's going to support a guy while he's saying essentially that Trump disgusts him, that he's going to support him? It feels as though Ryan has in some ways damaged himself. There's lots of political comebacks, but I don't know if you feel the same way.
I think that a lot of people have respect for Paul Ryan. I think on the right and the left, a lot of people have respect for Paul Ryan. And I think a lot of people understand what a difficult position he's been in this election. So I think he has potential after this election. Absolutely. I don't know that he's going to emerge as the leader of the new right, but I think he definitely has potential to to be a leader.
I think Paul Ryan's going to be just fine. I mean, he's been frozen out in no man's land for a really long time. It didn't start over the weekend. He's had four or five junctures of this campaign where he's going to come out against Trump and said, whether it's talking about how you can't get a fair trial from a Mexican judge, you know, he's had a bunch of moments where he's come out and said, well, that's not really what we think. And, I'm really disturbed by that. But then he's kind of stayed nominally on the bus. Probably, and you can understand for all of the reasons that Suzanne's talking about why he would do that. Ultimately, I think that will be understood. I think probably the more he moves away from Trump, the faster, and he certainly did that starting Monday in a whole big new way, the better off he's going to be. And people are giving everybody's giving everybody else a lot of permission right now. If you saw, for example, the words of Glenn Beck, not that people really pay that much attention to what Glenn Beck says, but, you know, that it's a moral and ethical thing to do to decide you're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. I mean, people are creating a lot of space for other Republicans to function in and to move away from this stuff.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get some of your phone calls, 860-275-7266. You can always comment at our website, WNPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WMPR Wheelhouse. We're here with Colin McEnroe, Bill Curry, and Suzanne Bates. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're taking a look at the week's news with Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, Democratic political analyst Bill Curry, and also Colin McEnroe, who's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What is on your show today, Colin?
Well, John, want to get away?
I do, actually.
A lot of people
thanks.
Do, yeah. So we fell in love a long time ago with a website called Atlas Obscura, which specializes in particularly working with its users to sort of track down this really kind of amazingly quirky or weird or disturbing things all over the world. But when you visit a city, you know, they know the six weird little museums that nobody's ever heard of or strange little things that you can go look at or things that have weird legends behind them. And they've put out this beautiful book compiling a lot of those things. So we got back together with them for this show. I'm talking about it in the past tense because we've already recorded it, but it's a lot of fun.
That is so up your alley, boy. Man, is it dedicated to you? Is there something there in the frontispiece?
I totally relate to this. Too.
Are you in this book? Is that what you're doing with this? You're in it, aren't you?
Some of the weirdest
Come
places
Hartford
in the world.
My final career. Yeah.
This afternoon with Colin McEnroe on The Colin McEnroe Show. We will get to some phone calls in a minute. Just very quickly, I'm going to take just my minute here and do a little bit of media analysis. I'm fascinated by this stuff because, as we mentioned earlier, a lot of Republicans, certainly Trump supporters, felt like the debate was a three-on-one affair. To me, there were so many problems with the format of that debate. And here's my very small proposal. We have three debates each year that are run by this commission. One should be one moderator, completely bipartisan group of questioners, two people on podiums, no audience. And do it formal debate style. There should be a second debate in which all those same rules apply, and you should open up the field as widely as possible and get third-party candidates. In this debate, Gary Johnson, Jill Stein would be on stage. And the third debate is one person moderating with two people sitting at tables, much like we are just now, no audience, just having a conversation, and then you actually get to learn something about the candidates. It's the only way this can work. Audiences, just in debates, it can't work anymore. I know we're going in exactly the opposite direction in American politics, but I just feel like without some sort of change, these things, Suzanne, become just sideshows. And I felt just dirty and horrible after watching Sunday night's debate.
You know, I waited a couple of days to watch the debate because I really didn't want to. And I wasn't as bad as I was expecting, maybe because I'd read all the coverage and expected like this awful thing. There was more substance there than I thought there was going to be. But you know, yeah, I actually like that idea of not having audiences. I like the idea of having a more bipartisan panel asking the questions because I think that some people feel like the questions are biased from the get-go. But, you know, whoever likes – I feel like the poor debate moderators, they have a hard time because nobody ever is happy with how things go.
No, I will say of all the jobs done so far, I thought that Martha Raddatz especially stood out. I thought there was a lot of really good work being done. I did comment that night, Bill, that I thought, as we brought up before, that she had an opportunity to ask a sharp question of Hillary Clinton about her emails, and she asked a flabby question about whether or not you can have a personal and a private view on something. I felt like that was a chance to actually ask a very sharp difficult question of Hillary Clinton and then follow her up. But otherwise, I thought Martha Raddatz did a pretty commendable job. Anderson Cooper as a sidekick.
I thought if you couldn't get Dr. Phil and Rod Serling, then I think that the Anderson Cooper Martha Raddatz tandem was well suited to the occasion. Let me just, you know, in the vice presidential debate, there were two storylines that came out of it. One was that Pence won, and the other was that Pence lied. And the problem is that people care more about whether you lied than whether you won a debate. So by day three, he hadn't won anymore because so many things he'd said that were inaccurate were played and played again. The great Republican complaint that it's 3-on-1 is because Trump lies more than any public figure in the history of American politics. There were 50 to 60 lies. Literally, everything he said was wrong. We actually had a discussion in the media about whether or not moderators should correct factual errors. I'd never heard that discussion before. Well, I come down saying they should, but of course there's so many. And so there's a piece of this that Trump is just such an extraordinary, garish car wreck of a person. I've suggested for the next debate that the one question should be, so Donald, tell us more about your mother. You know, and just to try to understand the origins of it. It's hard to – we won't get the – it's always hard to have a real debate in an election. It's actually the worst time to have a debate. But this is the best example, that worst example I've ever seen. As soon as this is over, we can start talking about things that actually matter again.
Yeah, that mother question is used in Blade Runner to find out whether somebody's a replicant or not. So,
I've seen that film so many times. I didn't know where I got that idea. Right. That must have been it. Yeah.
First of all, with the I'm down with the no audience idea too. I don't think the audience adds anything. There's a woman not too far from where we're sitting right now is going to be very happy that we're all saying this. She doesn't like the audiences, but. You know, look, there are a lot of different ways to do debates, and I can't remember whether I pointed this out last time, but from 1960 to 1976, we didn't have any debates at all. We went 16 years without having televised presidential debates. In one of the primary debates, I think it was in 92, Phil Donahue introduced both Democratic candidates. I think it was Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown, but don't hold me to this, but I think it was that year, and then he didn't say another thing. You just let them talk. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to do this. What it is right now essentially is a joint campaign appearance, right? It's really both of them doing this. And it's sort of seeing how you function, particularly in the town hall format, in space, as they say in football. And it's almost a measure of that more than anything else. I don't think either one of these candidates was very good in a town hall format. I mean, it wasn't hard to be better than Trump.
In space.
How you move around, how you interact with people. Yes. Like, you know.
Oh, that's the NFL combine. Right. I mean, this is the thing. I don't understand.
Outer space.
I don't understand how that's a qualification for being president.
No, it's not. It absolutely is not. And you know, it is much more of a test of a certain set of media skills. I don't think either one of them were particularly good. I also don't think this was much of a town hall debate. I mean, really, what Raddatz and Cooper did was take over. I think there was 24 minutes between the first question and the second question.
And to go to John's point, I just want to underscore one thing I forgot to say was whether I agreed with your proposal, and I do. I think it's really good. I like the part about having at least one in which the other candidates get to appear, and I agree with all the observations that you made. All these, when they take questions from Facebook, you know, we take questions from the audience, they forget that they pretend as if all these questions weren't completely curated. It's only an optical illusion to begin with. There is no meaningful audience participation because they have had all the questions in advance and know exactly what they're getting, and they pick the ones they want. In the Facebook thing, you get 2,000, 10,000, 100,000 suggestions. You pick the four you want.
I want to disagree with that a little bit and say I think there's room for this because some of it is how you function with people. And I'll give you an example from the debate. So this Muslim woman asks Donald Trump a question about Islamophobia. He basically lectures her for 2 minutes about how she has to turn more people in and brings up this false thing about how lots of people walked through this bomb-filled room in San Bernardino and didn't do anything about it. There isn't a shred of support for that particular idea, but whatever. So that's his answer. Clinton doesn't do much better. As she walked towards that woman, which she'd been trained to do, I thought, acknowledge this woman's humanity. Say something like, I'm sorry you ever had to hear things like that. That's what you do in that debate to sort of prove that you actually have some kind of human connection. Yeah, a little bit of it's a media trick, but a little bit of it is these are real people. And I think, I believe anyway, it's why I did the show yesterday. It's why I did a thing at Watkinson last week. You get human beings, get bodies into a room.
Then don't screen the questions.
Yeah, and then let people talk to one another, and there is something that comes out of
it. I will say that because we had this quote-unquote town hall-style debate, we did get a chance to hear interchanges like the one Colin just said, which I thought was a very good question, and we also got to meet Ken Bone.
Yeah!
And I think
wow.
we're all
no,
very
stop
happy
it, really.
That we got a chance to meet Ken Bone. Let's quickly meet Dave from Enfield. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're on the Wheelhouse.
Hey, I think your discussion this morning is very interesting. But what I have to say is that essentially the next president's going to appoint at least two, as many as five, especially if they're reelected. Most of the conservative justices are 79 or 80 years old. Ginsburg is 83. If the next president is not a Republican, the conservative movement is over. I mean, you've got right now a liberal side of the Supreme Court that basically wants to support DARPA, wants to support this executive overreach, EPA regulating CO2, that wasn't even mentioned in the statute. I mean, it's just over for the conservative movement. And all these people like Glenn Beck and Hewitt from Wisconsin, that whole group there, it's an ego thing for them. And they're saying, well, in 2020, Paul Ryan will run. It's a joke.
Well, hey,
the Supreme Court's twisted. We're done.
Dave, thank you very much for that. And I will say this is one of the lead things that came up in Colin's program yesterday. This notion of what happens to the Supreme Court is on the minds of a whole lot of people who are making that calculation about whether or not, no matter what else he says, whether or not they're going to vote for Donald Trump.
So, really, yeah. That is. I think that's a lot of my friends who do not like Donald Trump will vote for him because of the Supreme Court. And I have to say, I mean, I think that people don't understand that even with everything Trump has done, Hillary still has this reaction for Republicans and conservatives. And I think really a lot of Democrats, too. You know, she is going, if she does win the presidency, she's going to have a hard time. We're talking a lot about what will happen to the Republican Party after the election. You know, what's going to happen to the presidency? What's that going to be like for her when she's leading a country who voted for her because they didn't like the other guy, not because they liked her? I think that's going to be I'm just really worried that the electorate is going to be so divided after the election. It's going to get even uglier than it did in the last Clinton presidency, which I think is a real possibility. And, it, you know, with all this activist court and the other concerns and this feeling that the media is with Hillary and that they're helping her along. You know, there are a lot of, and they're real. A lot of these complaints are real. And I think one of the frustrations that Republicans and conservatives have is that when they raise these concerns, they are just dismissed out of hand by a lot of people. But they're real concerns, and they have legitimacy. And I'm just concerned that if those voices aren't heard in a Hillary presidency, that they're just going to get angrier.
Bill, quickly.
Well, just that. I think it's going to be something different. I think there's going to be a lot of anger in the Republican Party. This is going to be just Shakespearean, the denouement of this election. On the Democratic side, especially if there's a Democratic House and Senate, I disagree with Suzanne's idea. I think we've had 6 years to look at how divided government works. I hope people are thinking about it. And considering the idea of giving one party the chance to be held accountable and the chance to make a government work. And if that happens, I think that the debate within the
Look
Democratic
at Connecticut
Party
for a second at one party.
The debate within the Democratic Party.
let me not jump on Suzanne. I'll push back on you in this, Bill. The concern for a lot of conservatives that I talk to is that when that happens, that means that especially if the Democratic Party is in control and held accountable, the Democratic Party will err on the side of more government. This is the conservative position. And they will. And if you are a conservative, that is by its nature the thing you want to avoid. And so it's sort of a false equivalency here. If you have a fully democratic government, it may be accountable, but it also is going to tend toward a larger government, which is anathema to Suzanne and many other Republicans.
And not just conservatives, but moderates, too. There are a lot of people that don't like big government in America.
You take my point.
And I do. Look, first of all, the country doesn't just want unadulterated progressivism. And again, that's why the Democratic debate is so interesting. Hillary Clinton said she was going to make Bill Clinton the czar of the economy. She should actually put him in charge of reinventing government. If the Democratic Party
just
isn't
– send them someplace for 4 years and just have them not even –
But it was the one thing they did really well when the Clinton administration was look under the hood and take care of things. Yeah. This government is in such disrepute. And So just looking at ethics and management. And the second thing is that it's only in this crazy debate that Hillary's proposals look like much bigger government. These are about as scaled back. She's going in with proposals that are about as scaled back compared to Obama or any other Democratic candidate. She's walking in what was the center. You can go position by position, and what she's basically going to be putting on offer is what used to be the bipartisan elite consensus of both parties. And that will be struggling with it. In both parties, there'll be an insurrection. But the insurrection, the Democratic side, will be over more relevant issues.
Colin?
Just to go back to a couple of things that came up earlier, I am concerned about the kind of delegitimizing of a potential Clinton presidency. I mean, I think most people think she's going to win this election. But, I mean, she is going to win the election, as Suzanne said, in a climate of people essentially voting against the other candidate. I'm not so sure that the media has been pro-Clinton as it has been against Trump. And one of the – Jeff Jarvis put up a rant the other day about this, that one thing you just never see on the media are like Clinton rallies where people are happy and smiling. You know, I mean, it's like you just never see that, right? You kind of don't see that kind of thing, because, in fact, the media is not that interested right now in Clinton's candidacy. They're interested in destroying or at least thwarting Trump's candidacy. They see it as kind of a civic emergency. So I don't know. It'll be an interesting thing to see how she builds – a mandate up. It's not impossible to do. It'll probably be a little bit analogous to George W. Bush coming in 2000, you know, with some real – I mean, it'll be, I think, a very different set of numbers, but some real questions about how it was that he got to be president and can he lead after that. But she's going to need to make some right moves and some good moves in those first 100 days to get the nation behind her.
Go ahead.
I think the concern that people have with the media and Hillary and Trump is that they don't push back on her with a lot of these issues. I mean, she rarely talks to the media, and yet there's not this pushback. She's had this very opaque, and she's a person who is very closed in general to the media. You know, it's why she moved those emails to that private server in the first place. She didn't want anybody to be able to get access to her, you know, a legitimate emails as the Secretary of State.
Yes.
So I think that there are real concerns that people have that are not being properly vetted during this election process because there is so much focus on Trump. Now, Trump loves the attention and loathes it all at the same time.
Yeah, he doesn't like doing interviews anymore. He only do interviews on Fox.
But he still goes on Twitter rants, you know, on a regular basis. I mean, he's in the forefront. Yeah, but I do think that –
that's not interacting with
I do think that people feel like he is not – or that she is not being vetted properly by the media.
And I think rolling back to Colin's original point here is sometimes this is to his advantage. He's flooded the zone so much with Donald Trump. He has taken away any ability for the media or any other Republican or even Donald Trump to be able to pay attention to Hillary. And unfortunately,
I mean, people have that. People have more power to follow what they want to follow than I think we give them credit for.
I hear what you're saying. Quickly, Randy in Southington, last word on this before we move on. Randy?
Hi. The commentator earlier who described the GOP perhaps coming out of this stronger kind of struck me, maybe both parties shifting. And I really do hope she's correct that both parties sunder into smaller, more focused groups, offering us more choices, less polarity and partisanship, forcing more government by consensus and negotiation. But the party with the main problem is the Republicans, because they have a fundamental internal conflict they have to resolve, which goes to her further remark that there's no home for moderates at this time either. Until the Republican Party breaks itself from the religious fundamentalists, a deal with the devil that they struck in the late 70s, they will not be able to resolve the inherent internal conflict they suffer from. True conservatives who want limited government out of private affairs, cannot simultaneously seek to control the most intimate private aspects of our lives.
Randy, thank you very much. A quick thought, Suzanne?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think we should put the blame on religious conservatives. I do think that a big tent for the Republican Party, I wonder, you know, I think with the way the Democrats are moving with some of the speech issues on campus that we're seeing and other things, I almost think the Republicans have a greater opportunity to make that big tent where speech is more possible and you can have people who disagree on social issues and other things where they can't do that anymore in the Democratic Party. So I do feel optimistic about it.
I think religious conservatives certainly have proven that they can compromise this time, right?
Wow.
Yeah. We don't need everything.
That is indeed it. If nothing else, we have seen some compromises in places we didn't think we'd have compromises. We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to shift to some other things because there's some state news we want to talk about. Aetna's changing some very important policies that they've gotten some notoriety for. More people working at work. And also, we're going to try to figure out a little bit about what we know about the governor's budget right now. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're taking a look at the week's news with Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, and Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Tis the season for political roundtables. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be moderating one next week at Central Connecticut State University, my old stomping grounds, bringing together some of my favorite political commentators, Suzanne Bates, who's right here with us right now, as well as Kalila Brown-Dean, who's often on this program from Quinnipiac University, and Ned Lamont, former gubernatorial candidate and Senate candidate. Ned Lamont is one of the, well, maybe not original upstart candidates, but certainly one that got a lot of attention 10 years ago. We're going to be looking back at 10 years since Ned Lamont almost took out Joe Lieberman and figure out what an upstart candidacy means today. Also, hopefully, going to solve some of the other issues that we're hoping to talk a little bit more about in American politics. This is happening next Tuesday night at the Student Center Alumni Hall at Central Connecticut State University at 6:30 p.m. Hope you can join us. Before that, I'm going to be moderating a mock debate between a Republican and a Democrat, one playing Donald Trump and one playing Hillary Clinton. We're going to see how that goes. That's happening next week. And Bill,
wow.
you're doing something this weekend that we wanted to mention very quickly.
I am doing, yes. On Saturday morning, actually, I'll be out at the community bookstore in Winsted on 414 Main Street. And for those of you who haven't heard enough of this stuff, Ralph Nader will also be there. And if you want to hear the argument for why progressives should be voting for an independent, Ralph will be making that. And if you want to hear the argument for why the strategy is better to put Hillary in and have this debate we've been talking about, I'll be covering that that end of it. And I promise you it'll be fairly entertaining.
So this is Saturday morning on Winsted at the community
bookstore. I'll be speaking at 11. It starts at I go on at 11 to make my pitch, and then the day goes on from there.
So start lining up early, folks.
Can yes. I throw one thing? Because yeah. we're on CTN right now. Yeah. We're being filmed by CTN. I'm launching with Ken Bone a half-hour comedy on CTN.
Yeah.
It's called That's So Bone. And I think it's going to be—
You're such an opportunist, well, really. Sometimes I'm just ashamed of you.
They
you
lost know, the you, Program Review and Investigations jumping, Committee. That was their big show.
To be jumping on the Bone bandwagon at yeah. this point. It's so sad.
They lost Real Housewives of the Program Review and Investigations
also,
Committee.
Also, by the way, I just want to say one thing. On Saturday, I'm going to spend most of the day celebrating Colin's birthday, and that is just like one huge extraordinary bacchanalia, but it's kind of a movable feast. And you want to get it, you want to get there, you want to find where it is, get there, but then leave before the police arrive.
All right.
169 towns. I'm going to visit that.
We're done with all the endorsements. Let's just quickly talk about the Malloy administration disclosing budget deficit to agencies last month.
High note, huh?
Shortfalls, which were excluded on his official budget report 2 weeks later. State Republicans think he's not being honest about the numbers. They want a nonpartisan analyst to weigh in. I don't know, Suzanne, are we hearing anything different than we've heard before? For years, we've heard that the Malloy administration is hiding some details about what the real budget numbers are, and that's not just coming from Republicans.
What's so frustrating is that it does happen over and over again, and I feel like he's moved to obfuscate more of the numbers instead of making them more transparent over time. And so, you know, and I think that the public has a right to know what's happening to the budget. We were at $1.3 billion deficit for next year before these numbers came in, you know, in a poorly. And so I think things are getting worse, not better. And we need to know that. And that needs to be part of the debate. And quite frankly, I'm concerned because there really isn't that much attention on the state elections because of, you know, the great sucking that's happening at the federal level. And it really matters what's going on in Connecticut.
Usually
matters.
The term is the great sucking sound.
Yeah. Sorry,
but it's just true. It's just the great sucking.
Stopped yeah. there.
That's its Pequot name.
Yeah, I wish there was more attention. I wish
means in the original language.
I wish we were having more of that conversation at this state level because there are a lot of state races that are being contested, and it's an interesting year in Connecticut. We get to see. You know, Bill, what happens when you have 6 years of single party rule in a state, and it hasn't been very pretty here in Connecticut. So,
and let me just say that when the numbers actually come out, I spent a good deal of time arguing with my friend Lowell Weicker when I was state comptroller and trying to get more transparency about these numbers. But it's kind of like Hillary's Wall Street speeches and Donald Trump's tax returns. When the news comes out, don't pretend you're surprised. It'll be negative, and it'll be just what you thought. And secondly, no one has to really wait for the secret to come out. We know that we're in profound trouble. And again, the debate in this state, who will clean this mess up? And I couldn't agree more that it is one. We will have different approaches to it. But this is a terrible mess. And for people who want property tax reform and
all kinds of things in government. They're going to have to figure out a whole new way to approach governance in the state of Connecticut because of what we've just gone through.
Colin?
I got nothing. I mean, besides what they said. I mean, once again, this is like the – I feel like this burned out, you know, husk of a journalist. This kind of shell game is as old as the – I don't know. I covered the Grasso administration. Tony Milano was always moving numbers around. I don't regard this as – I think Bill's right. We know what it is. It's a worse number than the one we've been given because it always is in these situations.
Okay. So how about this bad news? Aetna announcing plans for layoffs, early retirement package for workers as the insurer moves to reduce operating costs. They're even, Colin, phasing out some of the work-from-home initiatives that garnered them so much praise over the course of the last several years. Lots of bad news coming out of Aetna, the big insurer right here in our backyard.
Yeah, you know, and this sort of work-from-home thing is an interesting thing because a lot of people really like it in terms of, first of all, their child care issues. Families are constructed differently in terms of workloads than they used to be. And in terms of the environment, it's kind of good to get people off the roads. Suzanne's enormous van doesn't have to keep going back and forth.
I have many children to fit in that van.
I'm the highwayman who brought us climate change.
But then
there's this other notion, and I think you're sort of seeing it in that. It's one of the reasons GE moved to Boston, right? You want people collaborating in dynamic environments, and the dynamic environments aren't confined to the company building itself. There's this kind of, you know, Jonah Lehrer, you should pardon the expression, notion that people do a lot better when they're kind of bumping into one another. Not just inside the Aetna building, wherever that is, but out on the streets of wherever that is. That's why companies are moving back to cities, too. I assume you're seeing a little bit of that in the don't work from home thing.
Bill?
Yeah, it's a one of the trade-offs here is about climate change, by the way, and environmental policy, transportation policy. If all these companies really were moving to cities, and if we were fixing the infrastructure, our public infrastructure, in the right way, then the principles that Colin cited, which I actually agree with and believe in, could work. Under the present infrastructure, they won't work well enough in enough places. That said, I'll just observe that it will be Connecticut's fate for the next 10 years to have every single day one of its major employers in some major flux, either internally or in consideration of moving elsewhere.
And Suzanne, what should we think about that?
I think that we all need to be concerned about Aetna's behavior here in the state because there has been a lot of displeasure with how things have gone in Connecticut. And if they do, what I'm hearing is that they're not necessarily cutting their workforce here so far, but this may latest cut they may, but that they're adding personnel elsewhere. There's a belief among business leaders that this state is hostile to them. And you know, they're upset, they're angry, they're frustrated with the climate that they're experiencing here. And I don't – what's going to change that's going to make that better? We've had the slowest job growth in the country over the last 25 years. Jobs – people need jobs. So we need these businesses. And I think this idea that we can, you know, be terrible to these business leaders and these businesses and then expect them to want to stay here and grow jobs is wrong.
15 seconds, Bill.
And Pfizer didn't go to Rhode Island because we didn't give them enough, and GE didn't go to Boston because they hadn't paid any taxes at all. The answer is to take the businesses that really are mistreated, the small businesses, and create a tax structure and a regulatory climate that helps them.
Colin, I'm going to give you the last word on something we haven't talked about today.
Just a little thing from the Hollywood Reporter. It's a piece on the Brentwood home of Frank Luntz, who's a West Hartford native, graduate of Hall High School, of course, famous dial-running Republican research consultant. Among other things, he has an Oval Office replica that reflects more than 70 years of presidential history. The desk is modeled after JFK's. The phones evoke LBJ's. The moldings are borrowed from Reagan. And hanging in the bathroom next to the Oval Office is a version of the famous blue dress worn by Monica Lewinsky. Frank, that is really weird.
It's really weird. This is his actual home. He lives there?
Wow. He lives in the house with the blue dress. Ball. That is
Holy
weird, Frank.
Smoke. Dude.
Colin McEnroe, host of the Yikes. Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, the next host of Cribs on CTN. Bill
with
Curry
Ken Bone.
With Ken Bone, Democratic political analyst. Thank you, Bill. Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. She'll be with me next Tuesday night, 6:30 at Central Connecticut State University. Thanks for joining us in the Wheelhouse.